before you get ready, I'll say just a few things.
Yes.
IMC, it's great to reconnect with people and to see people's lives being transformed over a lifetime, where you've been somebody for decades, maybe you haven't seen them for decades, and you meet back up, your lives intersect. And you still say they've grown in Christ and have a beautiful relationship with them. Also, it's a punch in the gut when you hear about people that you knew whose lives have ended tragically. There was a young man that when I was at GBS, he gave me rides to UPS. We both worked at UPS. He married into a family that a number of you know. And he was climbing in UPS as a supervisor in management. And his father had been an alcoholic. He said he hated drinking, hated alcohol. He started drinking socially and became an alcoholic. He left his wife and small children. Eventually, he was homeless on the streets. And I found out that he stepped out of the bar and committed suicide.
No.
Yeah. Mm. Very, very sober. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit hard for me to sleep, I find out. Sobering, too, because when he and his wife were married, they probably thought they were embarking on a very fulfilling time, and it was joyous for them, but poor choices.
Mm-hmm.
I have tragic consequences for both of us.
Yeah. Well, you wish you could transfer everything that you have learned as you grow older to those who haven't had the opportunity to see what you've seen. But it's difficult to do. But
That actually speaks to how do we, obviously, how do we transfer what we have seen and values to another generation. But a big element of that, I think, is interpersonal trust.
Mm-hmm.
How much does the younger generation trust the older generation? And how trustworthy is the older generation?
Mm-hmm.
That's a big challenge.
Yes. And it, you know, all ultimately goes back to the issue in the minds of the young people, what is real? It seems to them that what is real is what they are currently feeling, what they experience, what they see in a short term. And it's hard for them to believe that the experiences of the older generation are what is real. That these things do end up going in certain directions. So, yes, conventions like this are an opportunity to reflect in a lot of ways, aren't they? Opportunity to learn.
I think it's a human thing to have the tendency to whatever you feel is real. And obviously it's a stronger, once you have a little life behind you, it's not quite as powerful, but unless you choose to seek what is truly real, your whole life you'll just be going on what you feel is must be what's real, and constantly up and down.
Yeah.
And
nobody's denying that the feelings are real. Yes, that's how you feel. But you have to allow the possibility that sometimes the way I feel is not what is the underlying reality of life. I have to deny my feeling.
You know, in ancient cultures, philosophers recognized there was something to this, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
From what I understand, it's just so interesting to me how very where it starts is maybe innocent, you know, I don't feel good, so I don't do what I need to do, or whatever. But it ends up being, oh, I don't feel like a girl, I must be a boy. If that's where it ends up, if we just follow our feelings, our whims, you have to slip down the road, and you know, it's a very dangerous path to let yourself start going down, and it blinds you to the truth.
Mm-hmm.
That's really
not
cool.
Even just what you feel, but what you don't feel.
Mm-hmm.
Spiritual right now, or I don't feel God close, or well, what's real?
Mm-hmm.
That's the you got to come back to that. He said he'd never leave us or forsake us, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what's real.
Mm-hmm. So it's a topic that doesn't make a real emotional sermon, but it really is valuable for how to live life, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It's kind of appealing to your feelings is not very appealing to your feelings.
Yep. I agree. So the Davis has contacted us, and they have brought home with them apparently some illness, or else picked it up once they got home. So there's some flu-like symptoms, and Caleb is having a hard time keeping things swallowed, and that's not good at all. So remember them as we pray. And I'm supposed to also announce that our scheduled services this week is a little bit differently due to the Easter weekend. We're going to have a Friday night service instead of a Wednesday night service, and have our communion service then this year. So keep that in mind. Hopefully that will work into your schedule.
The normal time?
The normal time, I would assume, yes. That's a long ways off, but normal's good.
Normal Wednesday time.
Right. 7:30. Right. Okay. Okay.
So I'm wondering if there was poor guy on a tour bus on the way home with a stomach.
Right.
Pray for Lucas.
Yeah.
Since God's not concerned about that, maybe if we pray for him now, it'll work.
Well, when you put that many people together in a building, there's going to be some things that get passed along. So.
It's worth it.
It's worth it for him to have it. Okay.
Can I say one more thing, too? There are two things I'm thinking.
But you're only going to say one of them?
No.
Okay.
Just first of all, as I get older, I recognize the value of a crowd like that. Where the thrust of so many of those people is to do the will of God. And it just struck me how they're not focused in general. They're not focused on themselves. They're focused on Him. And so together we come together and we worship Him together. And it's just such a beautiful thing to be a part of a crowd that is about Him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is wanting to be like Jesus. And I so appreciate that. And then secondly, just to try to, you know, the positive side of the brokenness of the people who choose wrongly. Those great stories, those two testimonies of those young men were so encouraging. And I hope that our people all can get to see those. We could probably, you know, I don't know what you have in mind, but at least talk about them at some point. And just, they really, they ministered to my heart. And I want to pray for those families. And just the beauty that Jesus can bring about life into our lives when we do give our all to Him is, wow, what a contrast.
Okay, maybe we can share that with everybody at some point if they haven't seen that. Anything else? Isaiah's a little different direction than this. Okay. Although Isaiah certainly was witnessing the passage of time and of life, and how that the lessons of life many times are not learned by people. So this morning we're on chapter 27, and yes, I am plugging the screen in. So I believe this is the last chapter of this first section of Isaiah as it has been divided and described by some. At least that's what I have in my mind. I, for some reason, was on the moment thinking it was 1 through 28, but anyway, we're getting near it if this isn't it. And so this is not a long chapter. I'm just going to read it to start with and then go back and look at an analysis of it. I think I will do this before I read it. Just give you one line here from Alec. He says, in literary content, this is as fascinating a piece of Isaianic mosaic as anything in the whole literature. Carefully composed and using pieces from many points in Isaiah's ministry. Okay, so analyzed on the basis of the original language, he says this is as fascinating a piece of mosaic as anything Isaiah wrote. So, let's read it in English. The King James English. In that day, the Lord, with his sore and great and strong sword, shall punish Leviathan, the piercing serpent, even Leviathan, the crooked serpent, and he shall slay the dragon that is in the sea. In that day, sing ye of her, a vineyard of red wine. I, the Lord, do keep it. I will water it every moment, lest any hurt it. I will keep it night and day. Fury is not in me. Who would set the briars and thorns against me in battle? I would go through them. I would burn them together. Or let him take hold of my strength, that he may make peace with me, and he shall make peace with me. He shall cause them that come of Jacob to take root. Israel shall blossom and bud and fill the face of the world with fruit. Hath he smitten him as he smote those that smote him? Or is he slain according to the slaughter of them that are slain by him? In measure, when it shooteth forth, thou wilt debate with it. He stayeth his rough wind in the day of the east wind. By this, therefore, shall the iniquity of Jacob be purged. And this is all the fruit to take away his sin, when he maketh all the stones of the altar as chalk stones that are beaten in sunder. The groves and images shall not stand up. Yet the defenced city shall be desolate, and the habitation forsaken and left like a wilderness. There shall the calf feed, and there shall he lie down and consume the branches thereof. When the boughs thereof are withered, they shall be broken off. The women come and set them on fire, for it is a people of no understanding. Therefore he that made them shall not have mercy on them, and he that formed them shall show them no favor. And it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall beat off from the channel of the river unto the stream of Egypt, and ye shall be gathered one by one, O ye children of Israel. And it shall come to pass in that day that the great trumpet shall be blown, and they shall come which are ready to perish in the land of Assyria, and the outcasts in the land of Egypt, and shall worship the Lord in the holy mount at Jerusalem. Now I will confess to you that in reading that through in the English, I didn't walk away saying what Alec Moitier said, that this is one of the most fascinating pieces of mosaic, because At first read, I really don't have a clue what he's talking about. There's certainly a lot of metaphors, a lot of images, but how to make a sense of it is difficult. Now, after considerable study and some help along the way, I can begin to get a glimpse of what's going on here, and it does have a little different flavor at that point. So let's take a look at an analysis of this. So he notes here that as part of the evidence that it's carefully composed, that the section begins and ends with two in that day oracles. Verses 1 and 2, and verses 12 and 13. So verses 1 and 2 say, in that day, the Lord will do such and such. Verse 2 says, in that day, sing ye unto her. And then the end of the poem, in verses 12 and 13, and it shall come to pass, in that day, the Lord shall do such and such. And verse 13, and it shall come to pass, in that day, that the great trumpet shall be blown. So in terms of the structure, we can see already that there is a plan. There is a symmetry that Isaiah created here with expressions like that. Verse 1 describes the Lord's victory in the supernatural realm like this. The Lord with his sore and great and strong sword shall punish Leviathan, the piercing serpent, even Leviathan, that crooked serpent, and he shall slay the dragon that is in the sea. It's impossible to say at what point this might have originated in Isaiah's ministry, and it may have been composed for its present place and function. The vineyard song in verses 2 through 6 is complementary to Isaiah's discussion of the vineyard in chapter 5. Okay, so we'll come back to the verses about the Leviathan in a moment. This is sort of a summary. But with regard to the vineyard, I would remind you of that passage in Isaiah 5, where he is writing in a very different sense about the vineyard. He says in chapter 5, now will I sing to my beloved a song of my beloved touching his vineyard. My well-beloved hath a vineyard in a very fruitful field. And he fenced it in, and he gathered out the stones thereof, and he planted it with the choicest vine. And so then Isaiah proceeds to describe God, figuratively, having taken such great care of the nation of Israel as a husbandman cares for a vineyard. And then he says, what more could I do? What more could I have done to my vineyard? Because I looked and it brought forth wild grapes. His conclusion is, I will lay it waste. It shall not be pruned. There shall come up briars and thorns. I will command that there be no rain upon it. Okay. So this is a pronouncement of judgment after having gone to great care to try to raise a vineyard that produced good grapes. So Isaiah here at the end of this section of his writing then has a different emphasis on the vineyard picture. In the early passage, the emphasis lay on what Israel made of the Lord's vineyard. But here it is on what the Lord will make yet of Jacob, Israel, his vineyard people. Verses 7 through 11 are a historical glance at the Lord's dealings with Jacob, merging into a promissory message of purging arising out of the overthrow of the city. Finally, verses 12 through 13 are two oracles of ingathering, identical in geographical scope, involving Mesopotamia and Egypt, the first of which has Israel as its topic, and the second an unidentified world community. The first does not say to what place the Lord will gather his harvest, The second specifies Jerusalem. This heterogeneous collection has been fashioned into a coherent presentation. And so here we have an outline of the structure. First of all, the Lord's victory in the heavenlies. Second of all, the Lord's vineyard people. Thirdly, the Lord's dealings with his people. First, past forbearance, then future atonement, then overthrow of the world city. And then backing back out of the outline, the Lord's harvested people, the gathering from the world, or gathered from the world. And lastly, the Lord's jubilee on earth, the great trumpet. So back to the beginning again, the discussion about this great action of God against these monsters. The entities called the powers in the heavens, or the hosts of heaven in the height, in chapter 24, are here described mythologically as two leviathans and the serpent. Note how the triple description of the Lord's sword as fierce, great, and powerful matches the triple description of his foes, serpent, and monster. So, in some translations of this, the description in verse 1 makes it look like it's talking about the same entity all the way through. Alec here sees it as three different things. So, the piercing serpent and piercing is the King James here. Most other translations do something like fleeing, moving swiftly. The crooked serpent and the dragon that is in the sea. So three different entities in Alec Moitcher's mind. This term Leviathan is used in various ways in the Old Testament. In Job 41 and Psalm 104, it denotes a water beast, real or imaginary. In Psalm 74, it is used figuratively of Egypt. And in Job 3, it is a picture of the truly horrific. To awake Leviathan is to annihilate the existing order and to plunge into catastrophe. Whether the actuality of dreaded beasts like hippopotamus and crocodile emerging from the waters gave rise to the thought of a great beast of the waters, or whether the name of the great beast of unruliness was figuratively applied to these huge animals, the substantial fact is that Leviathan stands for an immense power ranged against the Lord. But God's power as creator and Exodus Savior is ever greater. And the end times day, the day of the end times, will see his victory. The link made here between the mythological names, Leviathan, dragon, and the factual name serpent points to these forces, however immense, as created beings. One of the Hebrew words, Tannin, can mean a created sea monster from Genesis 1, a serpent or crocodile from Exodus and Psalms, or have a figurative use signifying overwhelming power, as in Jeremiah 51. The description of the first beast as fleeing or swift suggests an aerial power. Coiling, description of the second beast, is found only here and comes from a word which means to twist. The present reference can be either factual or moral with regard to twisting or both. The third beast, described as a serpent, occurs in Genesis 3 and doubtless for that reason is used here. The picture of the power of the air, the coiling serpent on the ground, and the dragon which is in the sea shows the whole creation infested with alien powers, which will be sought and destroyed wherever they are. And of course, we find in Revelation that the author there uses the language of dragon, uses the same group, Greek word that the Septuagint uses in its translation of Isaiah 27, to very specifically refer to Satan, the devil, that great dragon. And so Isaiah here pictures God as being triumphant over all opposition, no matter how great the monster is in the minds of men. God is greater. And that's a fundamental thing to impress on your mind. We can be totally disabled by fear in life. We can be paralyzed. Certainly when we're young and ignorant of what's going on around us, some things frighten us and cause us to be paralyzed. But it doesn't always stop there. Some people are paralyzed by different fears in life, fears of the unknown, fears of coming calamity. And you can't faithfully serve God if you're paralyzed by fear. You have to be free from those things. And so it is important that you in your mind trust Him with the things that are the most fearful to you. Isaiah here pictures God as wielding His great and fierce and powerful sword against the most fearsome things in the real or imagined world. The sword of the Lord. It's more powerful than the sword of Arthur. Yeah.
That's such a be interesting to know the language connection there, because it's such a different image.
The language connection is probably Latin.
Yeah.
But I didn't try to find out what the Vulgate said there. But a lot of times you'll find that.
Keith?
Yes.
I was kind of where my mind first went when I read this was the sea, I think, is often used as a figurative phraseology for the Gentiles.
Okay.
And so, potentially, what could be being said here as well is slaying dragon in the sea. Of course, I totally agree with the dragon being Satan, but sort of, in a sense, purging the Gentiles of Satan's influence in their midst.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be potentially another idea there.
Sure. And of course, for ancient man, the sea was a fearsome thing. You know, they didn't have submarines and they didn't have submersibles. They had no idea what was down there. They knew that it swallowed up ships and men and goods, and they were never heard from again. It just, in their minds, it's the abyss, you know. It's
creatures jumping out of the ocean. So if you were on a boat, you saw that. It would be amazing, but it wouldn't be shocking, because it's like, well, I've seen videos of that. But if you didn't know anything that huge existed, and all of a sudden it comes out, that'd be terrifying.
Yes. And there certainly, I'm sure, were stories of encounters with beasts from the sea that had teeth. And could take care of you quickly. So, and you know how fish stories grow. So, yeah. Just take a quick look at some of the other translations of that first verse. So the ESV has fleeing serpent, NAS fleeing, Complete Jewish Bible fleeing. So pretty consistent here, right? NIV gliding, but not piercing. So yeah, I'm not sure why King James went in that direction, for sure. Let's see the...
It seems like Meyer takes the word as meaning, so as having to do with flight in a way, as in, like, it could be like an aerial, like a dragon.
Right.
Like, I don't know if the same type of word would have ever been replied, but it could have been to, like, a bird of prey or something that would have, in a way, both flown and, like, grabbed onto something.
Okay.
So I...
He seems to go that direction on the basis of its swiftness. So the idea that that may allude to flight. I think he likes that because it takes care of the three domains, air, earth, and water. But yeah, interesting how language works. But certainly, if all you had was the King James, you wouldn't get anything about swiftness or gliding from piercing.
I'm pretty sure if you get picked up by talons, you get pierced at some point. So
could be, yeah. If you're thinking bird, you can see that. Yeah. Okay. At any rate, the message of Isaiah is God with his unstoppable sword will take care of all those foes. So verses 2 through 6, God's vineyard people destined to fill the world. This is the final song in the great cantata of chapters 24 through 27. Verse 2, the vineyard is a delight. Verse 2 says, in that day sing ye unto her, a vineyard of red wine. Verse 3 says, it is under the Lord's constant provision and protection. I, the Lord, do keep it. I will water it every moment, lest any hurt it. I will keep it night and day. Verse 4 says, it enjoys peace with God and is free of the intrusion or corrupting of anything else. Fury is not in me. Who would set the briars and thorns against me in battle? I will go through them. I would burn them together. And then we have an offer of peace with God to all, even the thorns, if they will. Or, in verse 5, let him take hold of my strength, that he may make peace with me, and he shall make peace with me. Verses 4 and 5 are mixed metaphor. Hypothetically, battling with weeds develops into the war-peace motif of verse 5, 2, the second half. The Hebrew is exclamatory. In that day, a delightful vineyard, sing of it. So, Alec tends to make multiple passes at things. So we have sort of a overview, and then we go back and we talk about it some more. So verse 3 again, this verse speaks of a total divine work. And so I always have to refer back to verses because I don't have it memorized. What does that mean? Okay, I the Lord do keep it. I will water it every moment, lest any hurt it. I will keep it night and day. So he says it's all about God's work there. God keeping it. This work is carried on without intermission, continually. Compare with Psalm 121. Which I thought was a nice thing to do. Let's read this psalm. I will lift up mine eyes unto the hills from whence cometh my help. My help cometh from the Lord, which made heaven and earth. He will not suffer thy foot to be moved. He that keepeth thee will not slumber. Behold, he that keepeth Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. Okay, so this is a description of protection and care that we always hope also reflects, in a worldly sense and an earthly sense, the kind of watching and care that those that we entrust our well-being to on earth are engaged in. We would like to think that there are agents of the law, of law and order, that watch day and night for lawlessness and do something about it if they see it. We would like to think that really bad things can't happen because there are those who are vigilant and who are carefully watching. Well, those kind of assumptions we have often seen are ill-founded. That's not the case. It's not that we are guaranteed security on this earth. But we can trust in one who is above and beyond all that. Behold, he that keepeth Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord is my keeper, is thy keeper. The Lord is thy shade upon thy right hand. The sun shall not smite thee by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord shall preserve thee from all evil. He shall preserve thy soul. The Lord shall preserve thy going out and thy coming in, from this time forth and even forevermore. So Isaiah was writing in that vein when he spoke of the Lord keeping the vineyard. Verse 4, where he says something about wrath in the King James. What is it here? Fury is not in me. Literally, anger there is not to me, meaning I have no anger at all. And that sharply contrasts with chapter 5 of Isaiah, the vineyard described there, where he says, "And now go to, I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will take away the hedge thereof, and it shall be eaten up, and break down the wall thereof, and it shall be trodden down. And I will lay it waste, it shall not be pruned, nor digged, and there shall come up briars and thorns. I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it." So major, major change from the picture here. Now, you really can't appreciate Isaiah's references to briars and thorns unless you've experienced them personally. And being that I occasionally am in the woods cutting timber, I have experienced them up close and personal. And they're a real problem. There are different kinds of briars out there, and some of them you can pretty well just walk through, and they break off, and sometimes they break off in you. You have to dig them out later, but they kind of just let you go through. But there are others that they're so designed that when you contact them at one point and try to pull away, the rest of the branch comes down and grabs you somewhere else. It's just unbelievable how effectively designed they are to grab you, to cause problems. And so I can imagine that in a vineyard, they would not only compete for nutrients, but they would as well be a terrible hindrance to keeping the vineyard and harvesting the grapes and all that. So they show up repeatedly in Isaiah as a metaphor for opposition, for enemies, for things that need to be eliminated. And I'm all for it. They tell me that one of the thorns we have in the woods around here was not actually native to this part of the world. There's a bush called the multifloral rose, and supposedly somebody thought that'd be a great thing to build a fence row out of, keep your animals in. And that might be that it keeps animals in, but it spreads like all get out, and so you find it all over the woods, and it's not a pleasant thing to encounter. So when he talks about briars and thorns, I get that. The contrast then between this poem about a vineyard, which is a very positive thing, and the one in chapter 5, which is not. Alec here says that he renews the peace motif of chapter 26:3. Okay, that was just last week. verse 3, thou will keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on thee, because he trusteth in thee. And then again in verse 12, Lord, thou wilt ordain peace for us, for thou also hast wrought all our works in us. Except that here the peace is in the heart of God. Such is the Lord's zeal for his vineyard that he longs for a chance to prove how much he cares. Just let a weed appear. I dare you. Okay. Verse 5, the invitation to come to me for refuge is to the hypothetical weed, the opponent of the vineyard, hence indicating that vineyard membership is open to all coequally. The picture is reminiscent of the invitation to Moab to find shelter in Zion from chapter 16. Okay. So that's, you know, another incredible instance of one of the prophets recording this outward focus. It's not just about Israel, the children of Abraham by blood, but God has a view to bless the whole world through them. This certainly wasn't something that the Israelites celebrated and rejoiced in, and to some extent they seemed to ignore it. But certainly the New Testament writers pick up on these little hints along the way as strong evidence that God intended all along to extend his peace to all the world and have a relationship as their God, and they be his people. Okay. So this expression of finding peace in him is associated with the term stronghold. Tyre is spoken of as a stronghold. The word frequently describes the Lord himself and is not used of Jerusalem or his temple. Here, therefore, it is equivalent to find protection in me. The emphasis changes in each half of this repetition. First, it lies on with me, and secondly, on peace, i.e., that is, what is an offer is, what is on offer is peace with God, and it is real peace. In verse 6, the implications of verses 3 through 4a and 4b through 5 are now developed. So those verses talk about God's care for his vineyard. He shall cause them that come of Jacob to take root. Israel shall blossom and bud and fill the face of the world with fruit. The divinely nurtured vine fills the earth so that the whole world becomes the Lord's vineyard. That this was always the Lord's intention for his people, but was previously frustrated by their sin and its just punishment is shown in Psalm 80. But now the Lord is at peace with his people and invites every erstwhile enemy into peace. The total vine system, root, bud, blossom, and fruit, is wholesome and effective in every part. The names Jacob and Israel would most directly apply to the northern kingdom and could suggest that the verse originated as an oracle of hope related to the time of the fall of Samaria and the deportation of the northern people. In the present context, of course, the names have their original and time-honored reference to the whole people of God, as tracing their birth to Jacob, Israel. Okay, so pointing out that quite often in the prophets, whenever you see those terms, Jacob and Israel, it's referring to the northern kingdom as distinguished from Judah. But here he says it is reaching back before that time where those words just talk about the origin of the people. Now, verses 7 through 11. How will the people of the Lord come into the Eden restored of verses 2 through 6? The answer comes in this central section of the poem. The writing is compressed and highly elusive. In other words, it's hard to figure out. But the verses have a coherent and relevant meaning. The Lord has never been as harsh with Israel as he has been with its foes. Verse 7. Hath he smitten him as he smote those that smote him? Or is he slain according to the slaughter of them that are slain by him? Okay, so you might not have guessed from reading that Isaiah was communicating that God is not as harsh with his people as he is with their foes. That is Alex's interpretation of that. And he notes elsewhere that the Hebrew here is very rhythmic and flowing, but maybe not so clear. It's difficult to translate. So things happen in language when poets write.
It's hard enough to understand some English poems.
Yeah. So, following this line of thought then, the Lord's dealing with his people is not as harsh. It consists, for instance, of scattering rather than destruction. Verse 8, in measure, when it shooteth forth, thou wilt debate with it. Okay, so that's the King James, and let's see if we can gather from a different translation a little more, something more closely to what Genesis, where did that come from? What he's talking about here. See, this is verse 8. Okay, so the ESV says, measure by measure, by exile, you contended with them. He removed them with his fierce breath in the day of the east wind. So, that is understood to mean that it wasn't a total destruction, but, for instance, by exile. And there was always a remnant. There was always some that came back. So Isaiah seems to be suggesting that God deals with their sin, but he always saves a remnant so that they are not wiped off the face of the earth. By this, therefore, shall the iniquity of Jacob be purged. And this is all the fruit to take away his sin. When he maketh all the stones of the altar as chalk stones that are beaten in sunder, the groves and images shall not stand up. Okay, so those are clear references to idolatry and the destruction of the altars to idols. There were usually groves of trees associated with the worship of various idols as well. So groves and high places and altars often refer to idolatry in general. So that's how they're going to purge their sins. They're going to destroy the things that led them astray. They eliminate them. You get rid of that stuff. I heard an account recently of a man who in his youth was known for his alcohol consumption, and when he finally grew up and came to his senses, he didn't want it to be a part of his life at all. He didn't want it in the house. His kids came along and were sort of in a different mind, but they had to face up to their father's experiences. Nope, that's not going to be here. And so that's sort of what comes to my mind here when I think about, if you're going to rid yourself of the things that are destroying you, you need to get them out of your life. You can't put them on the shelf and keep them within reach and pet them and pamper them. You eliminate them.
I thought it was so sweet, the one family, there were some things that the wife was tempted to go back to that she thought she would be, and so when she became saved, they drove, what was it, 45 minutes or something, and put them in a dumpster.
Yeah.
She couldn't get to them.
Really, she was afraid she'd take them back out of the trash.
Yeah.
Yep.
Speaks of commitment.
It does. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that touched me so much that resonated with me, the young man, Sarah, was won over by people who loved him. They didn't pick him, they just loved him. He was willing to give up whatever he needed to do, whatever he needed to please God.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So, well, we're out of time. We have nobody to ring the bell? Okay. Thank you for your attention.